welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 26th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. There is a lot of news today to cover, but we'll start with a brief look at the weather. Today, it's going to be a high of 54 and a low of 43 and mostly cloudy. Tomorrow, there are going to be some scattered thunderstorms. High, though, will be 59 and a low of 32. And then Sunday, mostly sunny with a high of 54 and a low of 39. Those highs and lows kind of match the normals, which are 54 for the high and 32 for the low. And for those who like to keep track of such things, the record high was in 1907 when it reached 85 degrees, and the record low for this date was in 1955, where we only hit 5 degrees. From the Gazette's front page, their lead story is under the title, Prison Victims Were Selfless, Beloved, and this is written by Aaron Jordan. Two Linn County residents, one a husband, father, and volunteer firefighter, and the other a nurse, gardener, and aunt, are being remembered for taking heroic actions in a brutal attack that claimed their lives Tuesday at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. Correctional Officer Robert McFarland, age 46, of Ely, and registered nurse Lorena Schulte, age 50, of Cedar Rapids, were bludgeoned to death by two inmates in a failed attempt to escape, investigators said. The suspects, Michael Dutcher and Thomas Woodard, ages 28 and 39, respectively, each have been charged with two counts of first-degree murder, second-degree kidnapping, and attempted murder. They made their initial court appearances yesterday afternoon through a virtual hearing from the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, where they were transferred after the grisly attack. McFarland, who had a wife and three children, worked as a correctional officer at the prison since 2008 and volunteered with the Ely Fire Department since 2017, said Chief Aaron Cooper. Cooper said Robert was selfless. We kind of joked that the fire department was his second home. His family knew it. We knew it. As a volunteer in the department with 28 firefighters, McFarland would use spare time to write reports, charge battery-powered equipment, maintain gas monitors, and organize the fittings and hoses for the fire trucks, Cooper said. It doesn't surprise Cooper that investigators said McFarland and Schulte were heroes for sounding an alarm Tuesday, likely preventing Dutcher and Woodard from harming Lori Mathis, a prison employee the men briefly took hostage. McFarland said of Cooper, that's just the kind of person he was. He was always doing what he could to make things better. Cooper said he's been talking with McFarland's family, who so far has not wanted to talk with reporters. Memorial plans are still undecided. Schulte was born in San Salvador, El Salvador, and was adopted and brought to the United States in 1982, according to her obituary. She graduated from the former Regis High School and got degrees in criminal justice and nursing from Kirkwood Community College. Before going to work as a nurse at the prison in 2007, Schulte worked at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown, according to her Facebook profile. Her obituary says she had a green thumb, was a lifelong learner, and enjoyed cooking. Lorena had fun trying out new recipes on her family. She loved being an aunt and was beloved in return. Lorena will be deeply missed. Tuesday's attack started about 10 a.m. when Woodard and Dutcher went to the prison infirmary under the pretense of fixing something. Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Special Agent in Charge Rick Ron said Wednesday. The men had hammers and a metal grinder checked out from the prison maintenance area and were being supervised by McFarland. At some point, they rushed into an employee break room off the infirmary and used the hammers to break the glass on a window, Ron said. They tried to use the grinder to cut through the metal bars on the windows, but failed. They used the hammers to strike Schulte and McFarland in the head and also struck another inmate, McKinley Roby, who was trying to help the staff. Roby's skull was fractured, and he was transported to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, where he is stable, corrections officials said. Rand said Thursday investigators do not believe anyone else was involved in the escape attempt, including other inmates or anyone outside the prison. He declined to answer other questions about the ongoing probe, including whether there was video of the assault or how McFarland and Schulte raised the alarm. Corrections officials did not respond to emails or a phone call Thursday. Rand said it's helpful to have Woodard and Dutcher in custody, and also said it is easier when we know where our suspects are located. We don't have to spend as much manpower and resources to track an individual. Ron said there are some unique things about investigating a crime in a prison, such as security protocols around the building and access to inmates for interviews. Dutcher has been incarcerated since 2015 and was serving 50 years for robbing a Holstein bank and two Sioux City motels, according to RAN and news reports. Woodard entered the prison in 2017 on robbery and burglary charges stemming from a 2014 Sioux City home invasion, the Sioux City Journal reported. Jones County Magistrate Kristen Deniger on Thursday read through the new charges, to which Dutcher quietly answered yes or yeah to say he understood. Deniger ordered both men held without bail, which is not surprising since they already were incarcerated, but she added this, "I find that the nature of the charge, the seriousness of the charge, the fact that you're already incarcerated at the time of the charge, and the risk of escape are too great to set a bond." Deniger assigned the public defender to represent Woodard and Linn County advocate to represent Dutcher. Next, from the Gazette's front page, an article by Vanessa Miller titled "Harold Leaving UI Earlier Than Expected." Dateline Iowa City. University of Iowa Graduate College Dean John Keller was named Thursday as the interim president of the campus when Bruce Harold retires May 16th, an about-face from what Harold told Regents last fall about the importance of him staying on to be part of a, quote, meaningful transition. In a statement Thursday, Harold said Board of Regents President Michael Richards has requested that I remain president through May 16th, which will allow the new president the opportunity to begin at a date of their choosing. Harold's May 16th departure comes just 2 weeks after the time the board expects to pick a new president, April 30th, and likely before an external job candidate would start. In a statement Thursday, Richards said he was, quote, thankful that President Harold has agreed to remain president through the conclusion of spring commencement, end quote. In a second statement later, Richards announced that Keller, who earlier this month also announced plans to retire this summer, had agreed to serve as interim until a new president begins. Dean Keller has had a long and distinguished career at the University of Iowa, having been with UI since 1988. Richard said he is the longest-serving graduate school dean in the Big Ten Conference and recently announced he will step down from that position on July 31st. I am very grateful that Dean Keller is willing to take on the role of interim president until the new president starts. Keller has been serving as co-chair of the UI Presidential Search Committee and will stay in that role, Richard said. The statement also said he, meaning Keller, is not a candidate for the permanent position of president. Harold did not explain why he's no longer staying on until a permanent successor starts. He said in his statement Thursday, "In October, I announced my decision to retire as soon as a successor was appointed by the Board of Regents. I wanted to provide the board and our university as much time as necessary to conduct a search for a new leader." End quote. In October, the Gazette reported Harold told the Regents he'd stay on until a new president actually begins work and possibly longer. Harold said back in October, "I'm also reminded of how I joined the university 5 years ago. At that point, I could have really used someone to have guided me around the issues, strategies, meeting people. Certainly I got through that, but it took a year, maybe a little more, to get productive. So I would like to, if my successor would like, I would like to help them in that transition," he said then. "It may not take that long, and I just don't think it's disappear. I'm reading exactly as written. I think it's some meaningful transition," end quote. In his retirement letter in October, Harold wrote, "In order to facilitate a smooth transition, I will stay as president until a new president has started at the University of Iowa or the board decides I should leave." He took a starkly different tone Thursday, saying, "When I have looked for clarity as president, I have looked toward my predecessors for guidance, with Sandy Boyd serving as the North Star among them all." Quoting from Boyd's memoir, A Life on the Middle West Never-Ending Frontier, he said, "I returned to the university with the conviction that old presidents should never be heard and seldom seen," quoting again from Boyd. Harold's latest contract extension called for him to be president through 2023, allowing him to earn $2.33 million in deferred compensation. The state paid him a base salary of $590,000 in fiscal year 2020. Harold and his wife own a home in Colorado ski country just outside Vail in the town of Avon, according to the Eagle County Assessor's Office. Although Harold has been in the Iowa City position for 6 years, he remains registered as an active, unaffiliated voter in Colorado, according to that state's Secretary of State. He is not registered to vote in Iowa, according to the Iowa Secretary of State. While Harold said he announced his retirement early to give the campus plenty of time to find a new leader, a UI search committee has moved swiftly. The job application window closed March 15th, meaning committee members have had access to applicant names and materials for about a week. The group meets this morning to discuss the applicant pool in vague terms publicly and in detail privately. Virtual semifinalist interviews are scheduled for April 1st through 3rd. Hybrid on-campus visits for up to four finalists are planned for April 12th through 23rd. Community feedback is open through April 27th. The search committee will meet with the board April 29th, and regents will interview finalists and choose a new president April 30th, according to a tentative timeline. Harold, in his Thursday message, said the campus's next president, quote, will find a community of scholars, researchers, and students ready to take the next step toward a remarkable future. Also saying, each of you has created a university that by all measures has improved over the past 5 years. Student retention is up, and the university is setting records for national and international scholarships, research and grants, and National Academy selections. We have much to be proud of, and I have no doubt the university is headed in the right direction, end quote. And we also have one more local story on the Gazette's front page. This is also concerning University of Iowa, titled UI Rebukes Fraternity Again for Hazing and Booze. This is written by Vanessa Miller, Dateline Iowa City. A troubled University of Iowa fraternity that's been on some form of probation or sanction since 2017 again has had its disciplinary stint extended, now through the end of 2022, after campus investigators this month determined it hazed new members and violated alcohol rules and pandemic protocols. Pi Kappa Alpha, known as Pike, is one of the campus's largest fraternities, reporting 92 total members with nearly 20 of them new. This semester, it committed a range of offenses involving social events with alcohol and without COVID-19 precautions, new member, quote, act of servitude, end quote, and lack of supervision, according to the UI findings. Our investigation led to the conclusion that alcohol consumption by underage members is perceived to be an expectation of the experience in the chapter, according to a March 8th memo the UI Office of Student Accountability sent to Pi Kappa Alpha. Given that the fraternity at 1032 North Dubuque Street already was on probation for holding social events with alcohol and without COVID-19 precautions in this fall, the investigation focused on spring semester, accusations of misconduct, including three social events at the house the week of January 24th through 30th. Investigators, who conducted 25 hours of interviews with most new members and 10 chapter officers, determined that beer and hard liquor were provided to underage members at unauthorized social events. New members had to help cover the costs with required payments to a social fund kept in a chapter officer's personal Venmo account. UI investigators also determined that new members participated in acts of servitude, like cleaning the chapter house and member apartments, shoveling snow, and driving intoxicated members. The new members seemingly willingly did the chores, believing they were required to become full members, but investigators said the acts posed the risk of injury and mental or physical discomfort and also hindered student engagement. Some of the violations exemplify how systemic they are to the fraternity's climate. Take, for instance, a chapter requirement that new members spend 5 hours in the gym and 10 hours studying every week. These activities on the surface may not appear to create a serious risk to student safety or well-being, according to a UI summary. And it continued, however, physical workouts do create a risk of injury and physical discomfort, especially without the chapter knowing of existing medical conditions of new members. Hazing, as the university defines it, encompasses concerning activities that happen with or without consent. A reasonable person in the new member's position would see these acts of servitude as a requirement to gain access to the organization, especially since these expectations were not required of those who already gained association with the organization, according to the UI findings. Taking a broader view of Pi Kappa Alpha, UI investigators painted a portrait of dysfunction, for starters. The chapter doesn't have a live-in advisor as required. The UI report also said, in fact, members noted they have not met the person who, in name only, is the live-in advisor slash house director. The absence of a house director is quite likely related to the violations under investigation, for if they had a functioning house director, many of these issues could have been avoided, end quote. On top of the fraternity's COVID-19 violations last fall, placing it on disciplinary probation, meaning it's not in good standing and could face more severe sanctions, UI investigators this term identified offenses of its clear and consistent expectations. The UI report also said none of the testimony provided by officers or new members indicates chapter leaders implemented COVID-19 safety protocols. In fact, one officer indicated the men would not wear masks if and when they gathered together. Tipping off investigators to the spring semester violations was an anonymous email January 30th reporting Pi Kappa Alpha had been holding many social events with other sororities involving alcohol. The tipster, who officials never identified or managed to connect with by phone, said the fraternity provided a keg and jello shots for at least two socials, and according to the report, they had people packed inside the house. The anonymous tipster said new members were made to do embarrassing and risky stunts, such as locking pledges into small and hot spaces, fighting each other, and many others, end quote. Though the summary didn't catalog the other allegations, a survey investigators gave new members asked, among other things, if any had attended a roast at which others were humiliated, been required to wear clothes not suitable to the season, been yelled or screamed at, blindfolded, or had an electronic device taken. All 19 respondents answered no to those questions in what UI officials characterized as a seemingly coordinated and suspicious response. According to the report, the survey completed by new members yielded curious data. The very similar phrasing and word choices in the responses to questions about alcohol and parties, as well as the question about a myriad of activities that could be considered hazing, was notable and concerning. The article concludes, given the new violations, the fraternity's disciplinary probation was extended through December 16, 2022, and its social probation was extended through December 17, 2021. Moving to the Iowa Today section, there are two articles about budget approvals, one for Johnson and one for Linn County. We'll start with the Johnson County that says Johnson County supervisors approve $144.1 million budget, and this is from Lee Hermiston. The Johnson County Board of Supervisors on Thursday unanimously approved a $144.1 million budget for fiscal 2022, which includes $11 million for capital projects and $8 million in support for nonprofits, service agencies, and governmental agency. That compares to estimated expenditures of $158.9 million this fiscal year. Highlights of the new budget presented to the board during the March 16th budget hearing by County Finance Administrator Dana Ashenbrenner include $5.8 million in road construction and maintenance projects, $1.1 million in funding to support the new GuideLink Center, also $1.1 million for emergency communications upgrades, $680,000 for affordable housing initiative, $850,000 for improvements to the Sutliff Bridge area, including a new parking lot, restrooms, and signage, and $1.6 million for projects and operations at the Johnson County Historic Poor Farm, which now has community gardens. Ashenbrenner said, "We've got some things rolling out in the Poor Farm area that we think are important." The tax rate for urban areas is set at $6.30 per $1,000 in taxable valuation and $10.07 per $100,000 of taxable value for rural areas, which includes $3.77 rural tax levy. Most of the rural tax goes to maintaining secondary roads, but also supports items such as animal control and library programs. Ashenbrenner said during the March 16th meeting that the countywide tax levy is down 4.4 cents and has decreased over the last four fiscal years. Since fiscal 2011, the tax rate is down 92 cents, he said. County residents' overall tax bill will depend on where they live and what school district they are part of. For example, an Iowa City resident in the Iowa City Community School District, will have a total tax levy of about $38.50 per $1,000 of taxable value. A Solon resident will have a tax rate of about $35 per $1,000. The supervisors also extended the countywide public health disaster emergency to May 31st, which includes a mask mandate. Then we have a similar article by Gage Miskimen about Linn County's budget approval, titled Linn County Approves $156.2 million budget. Linn County supervisors on Wednesday approved a $156.2 million budget for fiscal 2022. The spending plan maintains the current county tax levy of $6.40 per $1,000 of taxable value. Though the tax rate remains the same, property taxes will bring in $79.5 million in the new fiscal year, a 2.3% increase from this year's budget. The rural tax levy, which is in addition to the county-wide rate for those living in unincorporated areas, is reduced by a dollar to $2.71, thanks to an infusion of local option sales tax dollars. The county's local option sales tax dollars are divided three ways: $2.7 million for road construction, $1.5 million for conservation projects, and $1.5 million for property tax relief for rural residents. Even with no change in Linn County's countywide tax rate, homeowners could still see a 2.3% increase in their county property taxes due to an increase in the state's rollback, which determines what percent of a property's value can be taxed. Commercial and industrial property taxes are unchanged, but agricultural property taxes will decrease by 3% due to a change in the state agricultural rollback. Budget Director Sarah Barrows told the Gazette, "Honestly, we are in a really good position given two crises." Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker said that the financial impact of COVID-19 and the August 10th derecho made this year's budget challenging. Walker said, "We are proud that we have been able to be there in a time of great need and deliver critical services without having to raise the tax levy. These are tough times, but like our community, the Linn County government has found a way to persevere," end quote. This fiscal year's projected expenses are $195.1 million. Overall, the new fiscal year's budget will continue to fund the county's priorities of public health and public safety, physical and mental health, roads and transportation, and environment, county officials said. The budget includes $13 million for capital project, a marked decrease from this year's $44 million that paid for derecho recovery, the Mental Health Access Center, and completion of the new public health building. With the opening of the Mental Health Access Center, Linn County is not pursuing any large building projects in the new budget year. Linn County taxes account for around 16% of the overall tax bill paid by property owners, with the remaining 84% of property taxes going to a taxpayer's city, school district, and other taxing bodies, including Kirkwood Community College. Additionally, the Board of Supervisors voted 2-1 in February to freeze elected official salaries for the upcoming fiscal year, which begins July 1st and ends June 30th, 2022. There's a lot more in the Iowa Today section, but I want to get to the Insight page, and we'll come back to Iowa Today a little later if there is time. The first piece on the Insight page is from Adam Sullivan in his At Liberty column, and it's titled NCAA is Kind of Like a Government. He says, "It has not been a fun month for the bigwigs at the NCAA. This is known as the most exciting and most lucrative season in college sports. Each year, brackets and TV coverage of the national basketball tournament capture the attention of loosely engaged sports fans like me. But March Madness is mired again this year with protests over the league's nonsensical regulations on players, and the NCAA committed another foul by shamefully relegating women to subpar facilities. College athletes do not earn cash compensation for their labor, and they are barred from earning money outside team activities such as brand endorsements, semi-professional play in the off-season, or monetizing their social media following. It's a system meant to preserve student athletes as students first, athletes second. But as college sports has developed into a multi-billion-dollar industry paying seven-figure salaries, amateurism has become a sham. Before the pandemic, March Madness was topping $1 billion in annual ad revenue, which reportedly makes up the biggest share of the NCAA's budget. It is the athletes, not the high-dollar coaches and broadcasters, who put their health and safety at risk in service to spectators and advertising. Most will never make money playing professionally. Jordan Bohannon, Iowa basketball senior and Lynn Mar graduate, helped raise the issue in 2019. Amid a wave of memorabilia thefts at the tournament, he posted a ransom note on Twitter. "Give us the ability to make money off our own name, and we'll give you your rug back." Players aren't even asking for a paycheck from their universities. For now, they just want the ability to profit off their own likenesses. They're sounding off on Twitter this year under the tagline, "Not NCAA property." A bipartisan bill in the Iowa legislature would allow college athletes to make money from their name and likeness. Senate File 245 earned committee approval last month, but has stalled since then. If a critical mass of states adopt such legislation, the NCAA will be forced to change course. Athletes get scholarships and some other benefits, and sometimes their accommodations are plush. Colleges build fancy training facilities, which are great for recruiting visits and hype videos. Other times, the accommodations are not so plush, as NCAA women recently saw. While men in the early rounds of the tournament had access to a full training room, the women got a few yoga mats and a single set of dumbbells, worse than an average hotel fitness room. Caitlin Clark, star freshman for the Iowa team, wrote on Twitter, "This is bad. Come on, do better." Mr. Sullivan says, "I'm no sports pundit. I usually stick to politics, but the NCAA is a pseudo-governmental agency, so it's a fair target. Most Division I schools are public institutions, and public schools dominate the highest levels of revenue-generating sports. Some schools support athletics with taxpayer and tuition money. Even when a sports program is self-funded, it still benefits from the school's tax status and trademarks. The NCAA itself is a tax-exempt charitable organization. The point is, the public has a stake in the NCAA and how it treats its unpaid workers." And again, that's Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column. The Gazette's editorial today is titled "Crack Down on Meritless Lawsuits." Our court system is meant to choose winners and losers according to the law, but sometimes even the winners lose, thanks to frivolous proceedings and hefty legal fees. It's called a SLAPP, S-L-A-P-P. That acronym means Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, and it involves filing suits with the intent of intimidating and silencing the defendant. Even if the challenge is meritless, it still can consume months or years of attention and hundreds of billable hours for attorneys. And just the threat of a lawsuit can have a chilling effect on news organizations and other First Amendment practitioners. These lawsuits are perfectly legal, but if they're left unchecked, they represent a threat to Americans' free speech rights. Iowa is among about half the states in having no anti-SLAPP law, according to the Public Participation Project, a group that advocates in favor of such protections. House File 456 would rectify that. It would provide for expedited relief in some cases involving free speech and free press. If passed, the legislation will make it easier for the court system to quickly dismiss frivolous lawsuits. It also would make some plaintiffs responsible for the defendant's attorney's fees. Such a law might have pertained to a 2018 situation in Iowa where a former police officer sued the local newspaper after journalists exposed his inappropriate contact with underage girls. The case was dismissed, with a judge finding the newspaper's reporting was accurate and, quote, "the underlying facts undisputed," end quote. But the Carroll Times-Herald still was on the hook for thousands of dollars in legal expenses. The publisher took up an online fundraising campaign to keep the locally owned paper afloat. Other SLAPP examples relevant to Iowa include a businessman who sued a critic over a Facebook comment, and a congressman from California lashing out at unfavorable coverage about his family's agricultural interests. Iowa's anti-SLAPP legislation already earned unanimous support in the Iowa House and is awaiting Senate consideration. It is supported by lobbyists for the Iowa Newspaper Association, of which the Gazette is a member. It's also backed by groups as ideologically diverse as the ACLU, the Family Leader, Americans for Prosperity, the State Bar Association, and the Attorney General's Office. The legislature's anti-SLAPP bill is a common-sense bipartisan measure to protect Iowans' freedom of expression. Before we move to the obituaries, we're going to give you a brief update here from the Gazette about the COVID situation and vaccination progress. This is written by Gage Miskimen. The number of fully vaccinated Iowans exceeded 500,000 Thursday, even as more than 200 people were hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide for the first time since March 2nd. As of Thursday afternoon, nearly 505,000 people were fully vaccinated in Iowa. That is 20% of Iowans 16 and older. And the total number of people who have been fully vaccinated in Iowa is now at around 525,000. To date, 1,354,035 vaccine doses have been administered in the state. In Linn County, 99,469 vaccine doses have been administered, and about 39,600 are now fully vaccinated, which is 21.93% of the county's adult population. That means 16 and over. In Johnson County, 26% of the county's adult population has been fully vaccinated. Yeah, the way this is written, I'm not sure if that is actually fully vaccinated or at least have been received one dose. I'm sorry, I can't be more clear. Hospitalizations across the state, 207 people were hospitalized as of 11 a.m. Thursday. That was up from 190 the day before and the first time the number had exceeded 200 since March 2nd. The number of patients in ICU increased from 40 to 46, but those on ventilators decreased by about half. Linn County yesterday reported 24 new cases with a 7-day average of 18 daily. Johnson County added 24 for a total of about 13.5 average since 13,409 cases since last March, and a 7-day average also is 18. Of the state's new cases, 96 were in people 17 and under, bringing that total to 39,845. Of the 19 deaths reported Thursday, 10 were over the age of 80, 6 were ages 61 to 80, and 3 were 41 to 60. The reported deaths took place from February 6th to March 20th. And as far as long-term care facilities, the COVID-19 outbreaks with 3 or more cases among residents and staff, they continue to report only one long-term care facility where 7 individuals are being treated. And since the beginning of the pandemic, 2,230 have died from the virus in the state's long-term care facilities. I want to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Gazette for Friday, March 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. We'll look first at the shorter notices. There are 3 from Cedar Rapids. Wendy K. Arnold Rodriguez, age 49, died Thursday, yesterday. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service is handling those arrangements. Also in Cedar Rapids, Harley Mick Clymer Jr., age 73, died this past Wednesday. Family is being assisted by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services. And Lorena Schulte, age 50, talked about her earlier, died Tuesday, March 23rd. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Ely, Robert McFarland, also we spoke of him earlier, age 46, died Tuesday. And Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Vinton, Carmen Worth, age 87, died Wednesday, and Van Steenhuys Russell Funeral Home in Vinton is handling those arrangements. Moving to the longer notices, Doug Case, age 70, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, February 9th. Doug's last wishes were to invite family and friends to a celebration of Life Jam that is going to be held on tomorrow, Saturday, from 2 to 10 p.m. at the Eagles Club, 1735 11th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids. Food and refreshments will be provided, and they specifically indicate please feel free to bring along instruments of choice and join in. Colton Eric Goebel, age 22, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, March 19th, at UI Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. No public services are planned at this time, but a service celebrating Colton's life will be held and announced at a later time. Those wishing to leave a message of condolence or memory may visit the funeral home website at gayandchia.com. From Coralville, Janice Strobe, or Strobe, S-T-R-O-B-B-E, age 80, of Coralville, died Wednesday, March 24th at the Lantern Park Specialty Care Center in Coralville. Her funeral will be held at 11 a.m. this coming Monday at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Oxford, with burial following at the Mount Calvary Cemetery near Oxford. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at St. Mary's Church. In lieu of flowers, they are asking for memorial donations to be made in her memory to the Holden Cancer Center, care of University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, or St. Mary's Catholic Church of Oxford. From Iowa City, Velma Irene Smith Fisher, age 90, died Wednesday, March 24th, at UI Hospitals and Clinics. Her visitation will be held from noon to 2 p.m. Monday, March 29th, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, with a private family service and burial taking place at Memory Gardens Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made in her memory to the River Community Church. And as with others, you can leave a condolence message through the gayandchina.com website. From Cedar Rapids, Ronald Blaine Olson, age 85, passed away peacefully at home on Wednesday, March 24th. Family and friends will gather from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday, March 28th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids, with a private family interment to follow at the Grace Episcopal Church Columbarium. Those wishing to do so may direct memorials to the World Wildlife Fund or a charity of the donor's choice. Also from Cedar Rapids, Barbara Frances Quigley, age 72, passed away at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital yesterday. A public visitation will be held from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, March 29th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people allowed into the visitation at one time and a required use of face masks or shields. A private funeral mass will be offered at St. Matthew's Catholic Church. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in her name to the Iowa Humane Alliance, and the family specifically thanks the entire staff of nurses and doctors at St. Luke's Hospice for the care and support they showed Barbara while she was in their care. A very brief notice is here for May Pfeiffer, age 96, of Marion and formerly of Sigourney, who passed away Wednesday, March 24th. The funeral mass will be held 10:30 a.m. tomorrow at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Sigourney, with visitation 1 hour before the service. In Hiawatha, Fu Bakam, age 71, of Hiawatha, passed away Wednesday, March 24th. Private services will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, but a live stream of the service may be accessed on the funeral home's website under her obituary using the video tab starting at 1 p.m. tomorrow. We have two more obituaries. First, Kenneth Kenny Bacon of Monticello, age 87. He was formerly of Hopkinton, and he died yesterday at the Jones Regional Hospital following an extended illness. Public visitation will be held Sunday, this Sunday, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Getch Funeral Home in Monticello. A private family burial will be held at Hopkinton Cemetery at a later date. Those attending the visitation are advised that masks must be worn and fitted properly over the nose and mouth at all times to enter the funeral home, with social distancing also required. And our final obituary today is for Roger Allen Sturtz, age 75, of Urbana, who died Tuesday, March 23rd at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private funeral services with full military rites will be held, but a public visitation will be held this Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. at Van Steenhuys Russell Funeral Home in Vinton. You are notified that masks will be required. Memorials may be directed to the American Heart Association, Vinton Depot, or North Benton Ambulance. The Gazette doesn't have much here today in the area of high school sports, but a couple of things. First is a sidebar article that is short and titled, Metro Public Schools Take Enrollment Dip. West Des Moines Valley is back on top in terms of enrollment. The Iowa High School Athletic Association has released its 2021-22 BEDS documents, the file from which schools are classified for sports postseason tournaments. Numbers are based on students in grades 9 through 11 from the present school year. With Waukee split into two high schools, Valley has the highest enrollment, a certified number of 2,141 students. Linmar remains the largest school in the area and fifth in the state, with an enrollment of 1,666, a decrease of 36 students from 2020-21 school year. All three Cedar Rapids Community School District high schools reported a sharp decline, 15.5% at Washington, 9.5% at Jefferson, and 6.1% at Kennedy. And one other article, this written by Jeff Johnson, titled Championship Puzzle Nearly Complete, subtitled Sites for Spring Sports All But Locked Down, But Baseball Still a Problem. Jeff says, golf and tennis aren't going to be much of a problem. Soccer appears as if it will work out fine. There's some question as to exactly how track and field might look and work, but its location seems secure. Then there's baseball. That one's completely up in the air. Iowa High School Athletic Association Executive Director Tom Keating said, it's another chance for us to be problem solvers. Keating and his cohorts have had a ton of practice with that during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa was the first state to resume prep sports competition last summer with baseball and softball after all 2020 spring sports were canceled. Spring sports are full go this year with practices underway. Though nothing has been officially announced, the IHSAA seems to have most of its ducks in a row in regard to the respective sports and their championships. Keating said the IHSAA expects to use County Park in Des Moines for its state soccer tournament later this spring. Its availability had been in question because of local capacity limits brought upon by COVID. As usual, Drake Stadium will host track and field, it appears, after some initial question about that. What isn't known are any of the specifics of the event, how many days it will run, if it will remain co-ed, if any fans will be allowed to attend. Keating said, soccer, we believe we have resolved with County Park. We'll get to a good place with them. I think initially some of the limitations look prohibitive, but our conversations lately, we are confident we can play there. That's good news. State track, we have a couple of meetings this week with Drake, and we'll know a little bit more. I think the track itself is going to be available, Keating said, but also added the question is in what format. So we're in discussions with them, and we'll know by the end of the week where we are with that. He stressed the IHSAA is being open-minded. It could be anything, he said. Maybe just a different format than what we're used to. Depending on Drake, there may be capacity limits similar to when we went to the Unidome for football. It's their venue, and we will listen to what they say for capacity limits. We're hanging on there and staying in communication with them. Tennis and golf championships are not expected to have any issues. Baseball, however, is a totally different story. The state baseball tournament is an 8-day event that has been played at Principal Park in Des Moines, but that facility is not available this year in late July because the AAA Professional Iowa Cubs have a scheduled homestand. Major League Baseball has taken over operations of the minor leagues and has set all 2021 minor league schedules. The iCubs normally would have been able to request being on the road for the 8 days of the state tournament, but not anymore. Thus, the IHSAA has a quandary. Keating said, that's going to push out of Principal Park, at least for this year. We are looking at all kinds of options. We've reached out to the University of Iowa, the Cedar Rapids Colonels, reached out to Carroll Merchant Park. We've reached out to local high schools in the Des Moines area. We've done a little recon with our advisory committee on some other possible options, some college fields, etc. But, as you can imagine, the biggest challenge with baseball is seating capacity. The Colonels are on the road for all but the first 2 days of the state tournament, but have politely declined an overture from the IHSAA, saying they cannot make it work. Keating said he spoke with officials at the Prospect Meadows facility outside of Marion, but lack of seating is a major issue there. The IHSAA even looked into the possibility of using the stadium constructed by MLB at the Field of Dreams movie site, but that was a hard pass because of the Chicago White Sox-New York Yankees regular season game scheduled there August 12th. "It's a bit of a challenge," Keating said. "We're not in crisis mode by any means, but we are in action mode. We've got to get something pulled together for 2021. Then that will give us a bit of time to breathe for 2022 and beyond. We'll see if the iCubs are able to work something out somehow, some way. If we can get back there playing, great. If not, if we have to look for a more permanent solution, then we do that." Keating said the IHSAA hopes to have a solid plan for state baseball going into its next Board of Control meeting occurring April 21st. He said, "The good news is I think we have a lot of people willing to help out, whether that's high schools or places like Merchant Park and Carroll. There are some places that have said, well, let us know. The problem is, the real challenge is, we've done this tournament over 8 days. To lock in one location for 8 days with the kind of schedule we run, from sunup to stars up, that is tough. We're looking at any or all options in terms of one site, multiple sites. The big thing is we want to provide a great experience for the kids who are playing, and we want to see if we can accommodate the fans that want to come to the games." From the Living section, an article by Michaela Ram titled "Time for Testing." Cedar Rapids resident Zach Douglas was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer when he was 38 years old. Though uncommon, his case is part of a trend that's becoming more and more common across the United States. Over the past 3 decades, the rate of colorectal cancer, or cancers of the colon and the rectum, has more than doubled among individuals under the age of 50, according to the National Cancer Institute. Over the past several years, cancer rates in people under the age of 50 have risen 2.2% per year, according to the American Cancer Society. As a result, that age group accounted for about 12% of all colorectal cancer cases in the U.S. in 2020, with a total of about 18,000 cases. However, even as cancer rates among young people are on the rise, rates among those aged 50 and older have decreased over that same 3-decade period of time, largely because that age group was receiving recommended screenings, including colonoscopies, some research suggests. As someone in his 30s who was presenting with symptoms but had no family history, Douglas's chances for cancer would have been considered rare years ago, and he would not have been screened, said Dr. Dean Abramson, a gastroenterology specialist at Unity Point Health in Cedar Rapids. Dr. Abramson said, "This is someone who a decade ago would have been ignored a long time by primary care. Taking that possibility into consideration is important," Abramson said, "because young people are presenting with more aggressive, more progressed tumors than older patients. However, because of their age, they are also more likely to do well with treatment." He said, "So the time between the first complaint and their treatment is important." When Douglas first began having symptoms, including abdominal pain and blood in his stool, cancer was not initially considered as a possibility when he went to his doctor. A month later, he went to the urgent care with the same symptoms, and health care providers thought it could be hemorrhoids, but the symptoms continued to get worse, and the pain in his abdomen became debilitating. He said on his third visit, the nurse practitioner immediately suspected cancer and ordered tests. The results came back, and Douglas said he was given 2 years to live. Still, he said he was relieved to know what was wrong. "Up until then, I had no idea what was going on with me. So at least I knew what was wrong and I could start treatment," he said. Douglas, who's now 40, has been receiving chemotherapy infusions for the past 2 years and said his treatment will continue for the foreseeable future until his cancer is in remission. It's still unknown what's causing this increasing trend of colorectal cancer rates among young adults. Experts theorize it could be related to poor diet, since that group tends to eat lower amounts of fiber and consume a higher amount of red meat and processed food. It could also be related to certain bacteria in the gut, which leads to inflammation that can be harmful, according to the National Cancer Institute. Family history is still very important as a risk factor when considering a possibility of cancer in a patient, said Abramson. He said, for those that don't have a family history or other symptoms, advocates recommend regular screenings begin at age 45 rather than the recommended age of 50. By doing so, doctors can catch patients sooner and even improve patient outcomes. Abramson recommended patients ask their doctors about starting their screenings sooner. Signs and symptoms of colorectal cancer include a persistent change in bowel habits, weight loss, rectal bleeding or blood in the stool, as well as abdominal pain or discomfort. And the article concludes, if you notice persistent symptoms, reach out to your doctor about a screening. And we'll end today with one more article from the Living section, and this is titled, Communities Help Shape Their Residents. This is contributed by Jacob Priest under the column title, A Family Affair. Mr. Priest is a licensed marriage and family therapist and professor in the University of Iowa College of Education and also the co-host of the Attached podcast. And he says, this week I got a text message from a friend. It was a picture of a house a few blocks away from mine. It had been tagged with racist slurs. I walk past this house almost every time my wife and I take our 10-month-old son on a walk. Like many homes in my neighborhood, it's a beautiful old home, built in the early 1900s. This home had been the feature of a story in this newspaper. Many homes from my neighborhood have been featured previously in this newspaper, and I've loved reading about them. These stories have detailed how these old homes have been restored but kept their early 1900s charm. But the story about this home was very different. It's the story that reflects the racist history and present of my neighborhood. As a family therapist, I often talk with clients about their family's history. When I do this, I use a tool called a genogram. A genogram is like a family tree, but instead of just birth dates and names, a genogram traces significant events and relationship patterns. These events and patterns, many of which have happened years before, contribute to the issues that bring my clients to therapy. Genograms help clients see how events in the past are linked to problems in the present. Communities also have important histories that shape them, and these histories have powerful effects on the families that live in them. My neighborhood on the southeast side of Cedar Rapids has a complex history, one of redlining and other racist policies and practices. The evidence of these policies can be seen on walks with my son. There are more Black Lives Matter signs than black neighbors. The reason I use genograms with clients is because their present often doesn't change until they acknowledge, accept, and take responsibility for their family's past. This can mean accepting painful things, talking about family secrets, or addressing how trauma has been passed down through generations. But when they do, they exhibit more energy to address their problems, have more authentic relationships, and have a sense of belonging and acceptance. But no matter how much work I do with my clients in therapy, relationships only thrive when they are embedded in healthy communities, where they can live free of fear, have access to stable housing, be able to thrive not only emotionally but financially. In my neighborhood, like many across eastern Iowa, this won't happen until we acknowledge and take responsibility for the policies and practices that have led to our segregated communities. So, how can we do this? On a personal level, get to know all your neighbors, not just the ones that look like you, think like you, or act like you. And when your neighbors, especially neighbors of color, tell you about negative experiences they've had in your neighborhood, believe them. Know your community history. Learn about policies that shaped who lives in your neighborhood and how these policies may have been motivated to give access to certain people over others. If you don't know where to start, why not visit the African American Museum of Iowa in September when it will have a new exhibit about redlining in Iowa neighborhoods, including Cedar Rapids. Finally, Mr. Priest says, take responsibility for the part you play in this and seek to rectify it. This may mean attending a city council meeting, getting involved in a community organization, or by using your privilege to amplify voices that have been historically silenced. Again, that's written by Jacob Priest, a licensed marriage and family therapist and professor in the University of Iowa College of Education, also the co-host of the Attached podcast. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, March 26th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.